Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, policy editor at the Bulwark and syndicated columnist, and I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Wall Street Journal and the Brookings Institution, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Our special guest this week is Patrick Fry, who writes the Substack Paterico, has been a long time a blogger, and is also a deputy district attorney in Los Angeles. He is not going to join us on video because of problems with criminals, which I'm sure everybody can understand, but we are delighted to have his voice with us. So welcome, one and all. All right, we are headed into the start of Donald Trump's first and possibly only criminal trial that will be held before the 2024 election, and that will start on Monday. It is the case in Manhattan regarding falsification of business records and or what some people call the hush money case, Stormy Daniels. So, Patrick, a lot of people think that this is the weakest of all the cases against Trump. So I'd like to know whether you agree with that, and beyond that, whether you think the weakness of the case has been overstated. I've read you on this.
Yes. Thanks for having me. I should say at the outset, since I've been identified as a deputy DA, that I'm obviously not speaking on behalf of my office. That's something they required me to say.
Of course.
I don't know that I would say the weakest, but it's the least significant of the four cases. I think that's kind of obvious when you look at what's at issue with the other three. But given that, I'm used to hearing people saying that this is clearly a political hit job, and I disagree with that. I think that this is a significant case in what's being alleged. I think the best way to sum that up is to just quote the judge who has told the parties how he's going to describe what the case is about to the jury. Mm-hmm. And what he says is, quote, "The allegations are in substance that Donald Trump falsified business records to conceal an agreement with others to unlawfully influence the 2016 presidential election," unquote. So according to the judge, this is a case about essentially election interference, about unlawfully influencing the election. And I think that another way of looking at it is, you remember that back in 2020, there were a lot of people who were losing their minds over the fact that for about 24 hours, Twitter restricted people's ability to click a link to a New York Post story about Hunter Biden's laptop. And they said, well, that's election interference. It's interfering with the public's right to know. What this case involves is actually an agreement between a presidential campaign, that of Donald Trump, and a media entity, AMI, which publishes the National Enquirer, to do what's called catch and kill, to find stories that would be unfavorable to Donald Trump, pay for them, and then kill them. So it's like the Hunter Biden thing, only worse, because it involves direct coordination between the media entity and the presidential campaign, and it involves illegality, because part of what was going on here was falsely reporting things to tax authorities and so forth. So I think that those people who say that this is just one lefty prosecutor's attempt to get Donald Trump and there's no substance to it, I think those people are entirely wrong.
So there's another point that people make, which is, well, this is a case that the Justice Department chose not to prosecute. And therefore, for the Manhattan DA to take it up, it should be foreclosed because the Justice Department passed on it. But you point out that they did prosecute and get a guilty plea from Michael Cohen on the same charge.
Correct. I've actually heard respected legal commentators say that the reason that the Justice Department didn't charge Donald Trump with a campaign violation in connection with these hush money payments is because DOJ did not consider what they did to be a crime. And we know that that's not true because, as you point out, they did prosecute Michael Cohen for exactly the same activity, and they got a guilty plea from him in which he allocated and admitted that he had violated campaign finance law by the way that he went about this. In addition, I think we need to keep in mind that the significance of the Department of Justice refusing to prosecute Trump, it's not significant because, number one, when he was president, DOJ has a policy that you don't prosecute a sitting president. And then there's reporting that said that when the Biden administration came in and the Department of Justice now technically had the ability to bring a case about these hush money payments against Trump, what had just happened right before Biden came into office, January 6th? And so basically the Justice Department looked at that and thought, we have more important fish to fry with Donald Trump in terms of criminal investigations than this hush money payment. So I will say that this whole argument that the Department of Justice failed to prosecute Trump for this, I think it's a red herring, and it's so much of a red herring that, in fact, the judge has ruled that Donald Trump is not allowed to make that argument in the trial. They have these things in trials called motions in limine, where the parties go to the judge with their requests in terms of what evidence can be presented and what arguments can be presented. And one of the things that the DA said is, we don't want Donald Trump to come in here and say, well, DOJ didn't prosecute this, or the FEC didn't file an action over it, so therefore, jury, you should ignore this. And the judge agreed with the DA and said, Trump is not going to be allowed to argue any of that. So that's so much a red herring that it's legally irrelevant in the upcoming trial.
Okay, what about, I'd be curious to hear what you think about the comparison between this case and the John Edwards case, where it was a similar situation in that he was accused of spending campaign funds to pay off his mistress. You know, he got a huge contribution from a big donor to pay her off. And the jury, it was either a hung jury or they acquitted. I can't remember, but it didn't work. It didn't succeed against John Edwards. What do you make of the comparison between the two cases?
Well, first of all, we need to keep in mind that this is not a prosecution for a federal campaign finance violation. It's a falsifying business records charge.
Right.
And so I'm happy to talk about the distinctions between the two cases. But before we get to that, I think it's important to just look at the charge that actually is before the jury in this case. And it doesn't, despite what a lot of legal commentators have told their audience, it doesn't necessarily depend upon proving that there was a federal campaign finance violation. The falsification of business records felony requires the prosecutors to show that Donald Trump was falsifying business records in order to either conceal or perpetrate some other crime. That crime could be a federal campaign finance violation. It could also be a violation of state election law. It could also be tax fraud.
And Bragg doesn't have to prove any of that, right? He just has to say that that was the motive.
Right. He doesn't have to prove that those crimes actually occurred. He has to prove that Donald Trump intended to commit or conceal those crimes. And so you could have a situation where, I mean, I don't know how much into the details in terms of what actually the case is about we're going to get into and how much in the weeds we're going to get into. But obviously part of the scheme, the basic scheme here was that Michael Cohen is paying Stormy Daniels And then the Trump organization is going to repay him. But they do it in such a way that they make it look like it's for legal services. But then if you're going to get paid for legal services, you're going to get taxed on that. So then they had to give him extra money on top of that. And so all of that got misreported deliberately to the New York State tax authorities. And that's another crime right there. You don't have to get into campaign finance violations. But to get back to your original question, though, in terms of the extent to which they do rely on a federal campaign finance violation, and how does this case compare with the John Edwards case, I think that, you know, it's always going to be a little bit of a fraught thing for prosecutors to show in a situation where a candidate is cheating on his wife, to show that the motivation that the candidate had for covering that up was to benefit their campaign as opposed to hide it from their wife, right? But I think if you look at the context of the way that this particular scheme came about, it's very clearly related to the campaign in the case of Donald Trump, because he has this meeting with the head of AMI, which again publishes the National Enquirer, David Pecker and Michael Cohen, in August 2015, after he's announced his candidacy, to engage in this catch and kill scheme. And all of their conversations revolved around killing stories to benefit his campaign. And we're talking about stories involving events that had happened years before. So I think that to the extent that the prosecutors are relying on a federal campaign finance violation as the other crime that Donald Trump was trying to conceal by falsifying business records, I think that they've got a pretty good argument that there was indeed a campaign finance violation there, and is also evidenced by the fact that Michael Cohen pled guilty to it.
Right. Also, there's the fact that after he won the election, Trump asked Cohen if he still had to pay.
Right. Yeah, so, if he was trying to hide it from Melania, then you would think he would still want to pay, but he didn't seem to care anymore.
So, Linda, it's already Thursday. It's hard to conceive of what a zoo it's going to be next week. I think every camera from every news organization around the globe is going to be focused on that Manhattan courtroom. And Trump will be there, by the way, under a gag order. And we will certainly hear from Michael Cohen. We've heard that Hope Hicks will be testifying, Karen McDougal, another person that Trump had an affair with and paid off, Stormy Daniels, of course, possibly Alan Weisselberg, who has just been sentenced to 5 months for perjury in a different case regarding Trump. Maybe the fact that he has now been convicted of perjury because of his earlier testimony trying to hide the reality about Trump, he'll be a little bit more unwilling to lie this time around. Who knows? But what do you think? Do you think people are going to say, this is so tawdry and I don't want to hear about it? It's old news, you know, compared to the other things Trump has done. It's trivial. How do you think it's going to play out? And by the way, it could be 7 or 8 weeks of trial. So, whoa, this is what's coming.
Whatever. Now, you know, I've already gotten, I don't know how many emails this morning from Donald Trump, from his children, you know, talking about how all hell is going to break loose next week and how much of my money they need to be able to fight this terrible cabal that is out to get Donald Trump. But, you know, as I listened to Patrick talk, one of the things that kept striking me is this is such a quintessential Trump story. This man could have avoided all of this if he had not been such a cheapskate. This is supposedly a multi-billionaire, and he couldn't come up with, you know, $100,000 or however much it was to pay off these women out of his
$130,000.
Okay. He didn't have available in his own personal account that he didn't have to use his business accounts, and then in using the business accounts, falsifying records, perhaps committing tax fraud, all of the things. You know, it's always the cover-up that is the worst. But, you know, you ask how are people going to react. Look, I think there is going to be fascination by this case. It has all of the elements that one have. I mean, you're going to have Stormy Daniels up there on the witness stand.
See, I thought that's what you meant when you said this is so Trumpy, because it's so tawdry and it's so tabloidy, right? I mean, okay.
Got sex in it. It's got sex with multiple women. And, you know, it was happening when Melania had just given birth. I mean, you know, to think that Americans are going to turn away, this is the stuff that feeds tabloid television and feeds reality TV. So the idea that people are not going to pay attention to this, they are going to be paying attention to it. Now, the real question is, what's going to happen with the jury? And is the jury, first of all, you're going to get a jury in which you have 12 people who are unbiased and are going to be able to render an opinion. I mean, O.J. Simpson died this morning. We all know about jury nullification because of O.J. Simpson. So I'm more worried about that than anything, that you might have a hung jury with one person holding out, or, you know, even possibly jury nullification with them just basically throwing out the law. So it's going to be a circus. It's going to be a circus that if Donald Trump really thought it was going to be to his benefit, why has he spent the millions of dollars of other people's money to try to delay this from happening, going into court three times this week to try to stop it? It's not going to redound to his glory, I will say that.
Well, Bill Galston, Trump put out on his Truth Social that it would be an honor to be held in contempt for violating the gag order. Great honor to go to jail for that. And then he said, if this partisan hack, he's referring here to the judge, wants to put me in the clink for speaking the open and obvious truth, all in capitals, I will gladly become a modern day Nelson Mandela. So the fact is, Bill, that he is no ordinary defendant, and it would be a real challenge for any judge to put him in jail, which is within a judge's power. They violate it. If they're held in contempt of court, a judge can throw you in the clink, to use Trump's term. But I think any judge would be very hesitant. But so the first thing for you is, you know, respond to anything you like, but also, do you think he's going to be able, over the course of 7 or 8 weeks, to keep from violating the gag order? Will he be able to help himself?
Of course not. That's the easiest question you've asked me in the past 2 years, Mona. I'd be surprised if he got through the first 2 days without violating it, or maybe the first 2 hours. In his case, the phrase contempt of court expresses a psychological truth, right? That's the way he feels about not only this court, but any court that would try to hold him to account. May I take the liberty of using a piece of my time to ask Patrick a question that puzzles me?
You bet.
Because, you know, this goes all the way back, Patrick, to the beginning of your remarks, when you summarized how the judge intended to characterize this case to the jury. You know, and he did this, you know, for the purpose of influencing the campaign. Now, maybe I'm missing something. As a matter of fact, I must be, because it doesn't look to me as though the law under which he's being charged is affected one way or another by the misrepresentation of business records that's occurred. You know, isn't it the same crime no matter what the motive is? So what difference does the motive make?
Well, legally, I guess it doesn't really make a difference. Typically, in just about every crime out there, the prosecution doesn't usually have to prove motive. Motive is, the jury is typically instructed, is something that if it's absent, the jury can take it into account in analyzing whether the defendant really did what they're accused of doing. If there is a motive present, then that may tend to suggest that they did do it. So yes, the motive doesn't necessarily make a legal difference, except in one respect, which is that, remember I said that this falsification of records crime becomes a felony if Trump intends to conceal or commit another crime. One of the crimes that Bragg has said that Trump intended to commit was a violation of New York state election law. And the New York state election law makes it illegal to use unlawful means to promote a candidacy for office. And so in that sense, the motive actually is central to the charges, because if indeed he was concealing the agreement and falsifying records to do it with the motive of unlawfully influencing the election, that goes straight to that New York state election law charge. But other than that, it's kind of a matter of motive that's handled in the way that I described. I hope that answers your question.
Well, it certainly clarifies it. Just one more question to which I should know the answer, but culpably don't. Is he in fact being charged with a violation of New York state election law?
No.
I didn't think so. So
he doesn't have to be.
I know he doesn't have to be, but if he's not being charged, then how can the prosecutor allege, or how can it be alleged, that he was doing it for the purpose of committing another crime? Wouldn't the prosecutor have to prove that?
Yes, the prosecutor is going to have to prove that he intended to either commit or conceal this other crime. But one of the things that it's important to understand is that the other crime that he intended to commit or conceal doesn't have to be his own crime. So, for example, Michael Cohen's violation of federal campaign finance law, it's another crime. And if Trump was intending to conceal that crime, then the falsification of records becomes a felony. And that there's clear New York precedent that establishes that the crime, the underlying crime you're trying to conceal or commit, does not have to be your own. So they don't have to charge him with whatever underlying crime is the basis for elevating it to a felony. But unless they're going to use somebody else's crime and show that that person, that Trump intended to help that person either conceal or commit that crime, then yes, they are going to have to show that as to Trump. It doesn't mean they have to charge it, though.
Isn't it great to have an expert? This is wonderful.
Yeah, I think this non-lawyer has taken this line of questioning just about as far as he can take it without embarrassing himself completely.
No, this is great, because not every lawyer would know the answer to that either. I mean, it's great that we have an actual practitioner of criminal law. So anyway, that's great. Damon, comment on anything you'd like, but also Manhattan, 70% of the registered voters, let's say, in Manhattan are Democrats. And so it is pretty much guaranteed, they've already started, that the Trump people are going to say, well, of course, it's a foregone conclusion that the Democrats are going to convict Trump. They hate Trump. You can hear it already, right? So do you think it's therefore going to be a wash? Oh, and one other way people say, oh, it could be a wash in terms of its political impact, I mean, is they say, well, look, let's say he's found guilty. He'd be a first-time offender. It's a low-level felony, not a, not a terrible crime. And so he'd get a fine, and that would be it.
Yeah, I mean, I let Mona know before the segment that I didn't have much to say about it. And the reason has become clearer to me as the conversation has gone on of why that is. I have to say, I am so not a lawyer. I am not only not a lawyer, I don't think like a lawyer. I don't defer in my judgments of these things to lawyers easily. I certainly think Patrick knows about 1,000 times more about all this than I do. And so on the technicalities of the law, I'm happy to defer to him. But I would also say that my expertise, if I have one at all in the world, is politics. And this conversation has indeed confirmed that this is going to amount to nothing. If you need a very smart lawyer to explain what the charge is, whether it's at state or federal, and is there a crime even being committed here, or is it just a cover-up of somebody else's crime, and all of the other things involved, like most Americans, they'll you know, tune in a little bit, and it will be juicy, as we were, you know, everyone was talking about. I just don't see that most people are even going to grasp what the hell is going on here and like what they're alleging. And as you indicated, Mona, if it is the case that he's convicted and then he's only given a slap on the wrist, the whole thing will just be a total wash. And now in New York, you indicate, well, yeah, I mean, there'll probably be people cheering it on outside the courthouse and, you know, really excited. It'll be great theater. But as far as changing anyone's opinion one way or the other, I don't think so. The other trials, I think, definitely could have. Certainly the January 6th one, if that could somehow take flight, that could, I think, have a real impact on the election potentially. But, you know, the fact that this one's going to fork, even aside from all the other legal issues, the fact that this one's going to go on for 7 or something weeks, therefore forestalling the start of whatever the next one might be, pushing everything further and further off into the future and closer to and past Election Day in November, I just sort of sit here and shrug my shoulders and say, is this anything more than a distraction? I just don't really think so. But, you know, that's me.
Okay. All right. Patrick, one more question for you on this, and that is, so I've been thinking, oh, you know, the judges are really hamstrung here because they can't use their chief threat against a misbehaving defendant, namely to throw him in jail in this case, because it'd be too difficult to. But so I was thinking that the judge doesn't have too many options for controlling Trump. But then I read that, no, actually, he does have one. One of them is that he can deny to Trump's lawyers the names of the jurors, which otherwise he would share, although not with the public. That's been decided already. But so that's interesting. Are there any other tools that a judge has to control a defendant other than the threat of imprisonment and the one I just mentioned?
Right. Well, I think you're right that the judge, who seems like a very good judge, by the way, is going to be very reluctant to, you know, toss Trump in jail. I think that it's pretty likely that he would exercise the option that you discussed of keeping the jurors' identities from the lawyers. Other than that, I think that the two main things I can think of are, first of all, just by his tone, his reaction, scolding Trump, possibly if it needs to be in front of the jury, doing so in front of the jury, just the way that he conducts the trial. And I have the impression that this is the same judge that oversaw the criminal case of the Trump Organization. And so he's familiar with the facts and he knows what he's doing. And he seems like he's very level-headed and knowledgeable. And I think he's going to do a good job in terms of controlling Trump to the extent that that is possible. To the extent that it's not possible, I mean, he has the option of barring Trump from the trial. He can just tell Trump, you can't be in the courtroom. You know, your conduct has made it such that you have chosen through your disruptive behavior to absent yourself from the courtroom. And I'm making that finding and you are barred from being in here. And I think Trump wants to be there. So I think that threat is something that he can use as well.
Okay, thank you. All All right, let's turn now to events in Arizona. So this week, Trump put out a video explaining his position on abortion. First of all, he took credit for overturning Roe, but then he pivoted and said that now it was up to the states to make laws on abortion, and it was no longer a federal matter, and that's his position. And he got a little bit of pushback from one pro-life group, although mostly they all fell in line. But just, I don't know, within 24 hours, the state of Arizona's Supreme Court announces that it rules that the 1864 law on abortion that was in effect in the territory of Arizona, actually even before it became a state, is now a good law. And so start with you, Bill Galston. Does that sort of blow up the Trump strategy here of trying to make this thing go away for him?
Trump blew it up by himself, right?
How so? Oh, because he made that statement when he did. Yeah.
In other words, he couldn't keep his mouth shut. Yeah. Right? Is he going to criticize every state seriatim, as it makes its own decision? I mean, I suppose technically you can square that circle and say, well, as a legal matter, the states can do what they want, but I, Donald Trump, are going to pronounce judgment on each and every one of them. Well, that sort of parses legally, but I think for political purposes, it completely undermines, the idea of just letting states go their own way. In order for him to get away with that formulation, and this connects up to the previous segment of this show, he's going to do the hardest thing for him, that is, keep his mouth shut. And I confidently predict that in this matter, as in the prior one, that will prove impossible for him. So, unless his senior campaign staff convinces him of the political truth, sir, they should begin, every time you talk about this issue, you lose ground. Please shut up, sir. I don't think that's going to work, but I suppose there's a chance that it will. But if not, he's not, even if he keeps his mouth shut, the issue is going to remain on the front burner. But if he can't keep his mouth shut, then it's sort of belt and suspenders that it stays there.
Linda, there's another problem with this approach, which is Trump is kind of misrepresenting what Dobbs meant. The Supreme Court in Dobbs said, this is not something that we, the Supreme Court, are going to rule on. We're not going to make law for the whole country on this question. They did not say that it is only a state's issue. There's nothing in Dobbs that prevents the Congress from acting as well. And so there are efforts by some pro-life groups, and many members of Congress have already signed on to some of these to have legislation at the federal level. So this, it's all over, folks. I moved it to the states. Argument is not accurate.
That's exactly right. And of course, he was toying, Trump was, with whether or not he would accept a 16-week ban. I think he even bragged about how he was going to get a kind of consensus on this issue. And
it was going to be beautiful. Everyone was going to be so happy.
Beautiful, right. such a deal he was going to cut. So, obviously that's not going to happen. But I do think that this action this week brings into stark relief where we are on abortion. They keep talking about a law in 1864. It was not a law that was passed. This was a provision called the Howell Code, which basically set a code of criminal law for the territory of Arizona during the Civil War. Arizona, if you don't know, was won in the war with Mexico. It was actually the New Mexico Territory. There was no Arizona Territory. It was all New Mexico. At first, Arizona tried to use the codes that had been developed in New Mexico, and then they decided those didn't apply. So Abraham Lincoln appointed this judge, William Thompson Hout, essentially create from scratch a code. It has in it such unbelievable things. It's not just, you know, abortion. It has to do with the rule of consent in rape. Apparently, over the age of 10, one could have sex with a child over the age of 10 if she gave consent.
Oh, great.
That was in there. Another item that was in there had to do with what happened if an unwed woman gave birth to a stillborn child or miscarried in some way and concealed that. She could go to jail for up to a year for concealing the birth of a child out of wedlock. I mean, they're just unbelievable things in this code. So the fact that this code is being used in the state of Arizona and that the Republicans in the legislature this week refused to allow, you know, this to be essentially revoked. The whole code ought to be revoked. This is a barbaric, you know, this is of a different time and a different era. And I think what it does is it makes the Republicans have to come to terms with the fact that they have a very extreme element in their wing. And, you know, this isn't going back to the world before Roe v. Wade. This is going back to the 19th century. This is going back to a time when women were essentially chattel, that they did not have the same rights as men. And I think it is such a gift to the Democrats. I can't imagine that Arizona is now not going to move pretty safely into the Democratic fold in the next election. And if you see Republicans doing this in a state like Arizona, which is a swing state, you know, imagine what they are going to do. And we know what they're going to do because they've done it in some states, in states that are much more safely red. I just think this case, I mean, I know there's been a lot of attention on it, but it is so shocking that you had this result in this decision, this 4-2 decision in the Supreme Court of the state of Arizona. It's just amazing to me.
Damon, it does look like Republicans are in trouble regarding this. I mean, Carrie Lake there, who is running for Senate, having lost her race for governor, which she claimed that she didn't lose or was stolen, et cetera. She's a pure Trumpy candidate. But she is on record as having said quite recently that this was a great law, this 1864 law, and that she was for it. And now, of course, she's saying this is, you know, no. And so she's reversed herself. And that's always a problem in politics, especially when voters care very deeply. So what's your sense of it? And if you want to even pull the lens back even further, you can ask, you know, we've been talking a lot on this podcast about, look, there is leakage of support for Democrats among African-American men, among Hispanics men, some women too. But what we really don't know and what, you know, remains to be seen is how much does this stimulate, you know, voters to come to the polls who might not otherwise to vote for Democrats?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is definitely the worst Achilles heel the Republicans face this year. And it's probably just going to keep blowing up. And the real irony of it for those of us who spend so much of our time kind of doing day-to-day punditry about the political cycles at this moment in American history is that Trump looms so large. And we're constantly having this argument about, like, is he popular? Is he's actually so polarizing? If he's at the top, he'll assure that the Republicans will go down to defeat, or actually does he galvanize certain segments of the electorate who, if they can be mobilized to show up, will have a real realignment of forces in American politics and actually, you know, maybe he'll do better than he ever has before. It's all Trump focused. And my friend Ross Douthat at the Times had a column this week about abortion. He's a genuine, probably the most prominent pro-life pundit in the country because he writes for the Times. Mm-hmm. And he had a piece about how, oh, all the polls are showing that, you know, the pro-choice position is just gaining and gaining in popularity. And he tried to make the argument that Trump is the reason why, because he's so hated and he's now associated with the pro-life movement because of Dobbs and the Supreme Court and all that. I think that is just flat wrong. The fact is that on this issue, at least, the Republican Party is incredibly radical. And actually, Trump, in his hapless, ridiculous way, is trying to stake out a moderate position. And he tried to do it by way of federalism this week. And I get why he's trying to do that. But as we've already discussed, it's not going to work because radical right-wing red states are going to keep throwing up new laws like this, and they're going to be new stories of women who are either arrested or their doctors are arrested, or they're women who have medical problems because they're denied access to medicine with their pregnancies. And it's the states that are doing this, and they're not Trump. They're like regular old elected officials, legislators, governors, and in this case in Arizona, Republican-appointed members of the Arizona Supreme Court who go back and, you know, all applause to Linda for, like, doing the research that brought up the details of that code that are in there besides this, that they would defer to that over polls that show that the number of Americans or Arizonans, I haven't looked at the Arizona polls on this, but if you ask people, you know, how many people think abortion should be illegal in all cases with no exceptions, the kind of down the line most extreme abortion position, it is 13% of the country. That is what Trump is going to be saddled with, a party that is in lockstep to that. And the last point I will make is there is a kind of delicious irony to all of this, because Republicans love to make hay about the poor Democrats and their very activated left-wing groups, the environmental activists, the social justice activists who seem not to care about the fate of the Democratic Party in elections. They just want to get their issues advanced. And even if it means the Democrats lose, because then if they lose, the next round of elected people will be more like us, the activists. Well, looky here. This is a Republican Party that is now tied by iron chains to single issue activists who are staking out a position very, very far outside of any mainstream. And it's not really clear what you can do about it. And the Democrats, I think a lot of them are going to be sitting around going, uh-huh, now you have a taste of your own medicine.
Patrick, when Dobbs was decided, people said, and I might even have been one of them, that the fall of Roe would benefit whichever party seemed less extreme. And in the interim, you have had what we've seen on the Republican side, which is, you know, these really quite draconian laws being either proposed or actually enacted, horror stories about 10-year-old rape victims having to travel out of state to get abortions, etc. And you haven't had stories about extremism among pro-choice states. So I'm curious if you think that there is any danger of that on the horizon. Is it possible that Democrats will go too far in some blue states where they'll say, you know, abortion for any reason throughout the 9 months of pregnancy, and that this will create a backlash against Democrats on this issue?
Well, I think the potential for backlash on both sides is there. I agree with you that right now it is the Republicans who are the ones who at least have more stories about their extremism and have more actual laws being passed that cause those stories to be published. I do think that Democrats tend to be pretty extreme on this issue as well. A lot of times when you try to press somebody like a Hillary Clinton or you know, a national figure on when is it that the state can step in, the basic answer, which they don't want to say out loud, is basically never. And the way mm-hmm. that they articulate that is, well, it has to be between a woman and her doctor. But what that means is that if a woman's doctor says, oh, it's psychologically difficult for this woman to have this baby really at any point during the pregnancy, including just before the baby's born, they seem to be taking the position that that abortion could take place. And I don't think that that is something that most Americans agree with. And I felt like Republicans were starting to win that battle of hearts and minds to some degree until Dobbs happened. And then, you know, we had the kind of the insanity that's going on now. I'll defer to Damon on the politics of it. I think that one thing that to keep an eye out for, though, if Trump is elected, I mean, there's going to be a lot of bad things happening if Trump's elected. But one thing that Nick Cotoggio identified that I thought was interesting is another one of these old laws could come back. This one's the Comstock Act. And that's a law like the Arizona law. I think it's over 100 years old. And it prohibits shipping anything intended for the prevention of conception or procuring of abortion through the mail or common carriers like UPS. And the fact is that this is one of the major ways that women end their pregnancies nowadays is, you know, through these pills that stop the pregnancy early on. And Trump, and by the way, I don't think that we should take seriously anything that Trump says on policy. He doesn't care about policy. He could reverse that position tomorrow. All his little fanboys would, you know, act like it never happened. And so I think paying attention to what he says on policy is kind of a fool's errand. But if he gets elected, it's going to be up to him to decide, do I enforce this Comstock Act? And he's going to have a lot of pressure to do that. And that could have huge ramifications for women throughout the country and for the Republican Party.
Indeed. About 60% of abortions now are through medication, not surgical. That could be huge. And a number of red states have already attempted to outlaw the importation of these drugs. So that is a really good thing to keep an eye on. All right. I want to spend just a few minutes on the failed Biden impeachment, because looking back, you know, let's cast our minds back to 2022. Republicans were supposed to have a red wave. They didn't have a red wave, maybe in large measure because of Dobbs. But whatever the reason, it didn't come to pass. You know, there were also terrible Republican candidates that year, et cetera, all chosen, handpicked by Trump. But they did win the House of Representatives, and they had promised when they were running that one of their first acts was going to be to impeach Joe Biden. And we heard a tremendous amount about the Biden crime family and Hunter and all the rest of it. And it has been the most comprehensive failure face plant that I can recall in a very long time. We didn't talk about it on this podcast, so I really would like us to just spend a minute. Alexander Smirnoff was the key witness, the one that Senator Grassley and Senator Johnson were making, you know, issuing press releases about. They had a secret FBI informant who said that Biden and Hunter, you know, both the president and his son, had received $5 million bribes from Burisma, et cetera. And it turns out that not only was he lying, this Smirnoff, according to the DOJ, which just indicted him, but he was also an agent of influence from the Russians. So, Linda, I wrote a piece today where I said that the Russian penetration of the GOP today is the most successful foreign influence operation probably in the history of our country. Because you have these people, they are mouthing Russian propaganda on a daily basis, and they do it about Ukraine all the time, but they also did it regarding Biden, Ukraine, Burisma, that whole thing has Russian fingerprints all over it.
That's right. Well, the only thing I might quibble with you about is that we did see this once before with Germany prior to America's entry into World War II. There was significant German penetration into Congress. And, you know, we like to forget that part of our history, but it certainly existed. You know, one of the things that bothers me so, and I get this a lot from friends who, you know, they claim not to have voted for Trump last time and they claim to have qualms, but they're always, you know, bringing up the so-called failed Mueller investigation, that there was no collusion. It is true, chose not to find collusion as a crime involving Trump in his campaign. But I think it was 140 different contacts between the Trump campaign in 2016 and the Russians. This is almost inconceivable. Russia has had its hands into American politics at least since 2016. Rather than recognizing that and being concerned by it, we just sort of wipe our hands of it and say, oh, well, everybody does it. And, you know, it's just another country trying to influence politics in America. It is not that. It is an attempt at subversion of American democracy. And it is truly frightening to me that, you know, you have Republicans on the floor of both the House and the Senate who mouth Russian propaganda points. You have U.S. senators out there spewing the Kremlin line on issues. And certainly we've seen it in the debate over Ukraine. And it is truly scary because I think it is underappreciated. And because perhaps it's been going on now for, 2016, almost 10 years now, is something we've just sort of gotten used to. And I think, you know, the Comer effort to impeach, well, they didn't, it isn't an effort. They did, you know, vote articles of impeachment. Now it is this huge embarrassment because the Senate has to do something with those articles of impeachment. And it has trivialized one of the only mechanisms in our Constitution, almost the only mechanism, that allows us to get rid of a president who commits high crimes and misdemeanors that are a threat. So I think it's really a tragedy. I think it has done a great deal to harm American democracy. And, you know, if the roles were reversed and you had Democrats doing the same thing, with the influence of some left-wing government coming in and producing the kind of propaganda and saw it mouthed on the floor of the House and Senate, I think the Republicans would act very differently.
Patrick Fry, any comment on this as a legal proceeding? Jonathan Turley testified before their committee. He said, no, I really don't think you've got anything to go on here. They had Devin Archer, who testified. He was a former business associate of Hunter Biden's. And he said, yep, Hunter Biden was a bad guy, but he had nothing to offer on Joe Biden. And now, of course, Smirnoff, their star witness. And there was another guy who also disappeared off the grid, I think, who was another one that they were relying on.
Yeah, I mean, I would just echo what Linda was saying there. I think that it's in a sane world, this kind of thing ought to break a party. The idea that they're literally going out on the floor and just spewing the propaganda of one of the most evil men in the world, you know, for mm-hmm. decades. And this is a guy who's, you know, massacred his own people. He's massacred women and children in Ukraine. I'm talking obviously about Putin, kills journalists, kills right. his political opponents. There's recent reporting that's even tied the GRU to that Havana syndrome that we used to blame on Cuba. This is an incredibly evil person and an incredibly evil government. And it just seems like the GOP is in their pocket. And it's just amazing to me that we can't find the fortitude to you know, fund the Ukrainians and to reject this kind of nonsense. But, you know, they're so upset over Trump having been impeached that, you know, they're just going to do a tit for tat on everything, whether it's deserved or not. And I only wish, I think, that they'd actually move forward with it and had it blow up on an even grander scale, because these impeachments actually seem to end up benefiting the people against whom they're brought, even when they're valid, like Trump's were. And if they'd actually, you know, move forward and taken this thing all the way to the Senate, in some ways that would have been great for Biden, I think. But yeah, it's just a travesty. I can't say any more than that.
Yeah. Damon, any thoughts?
Do I have to dignify it even with a comment? I mean, I really, the honest truth is I don't really have anything to say about it because it is all just nonsense.
Yeah.
And I agree with everything that Linda and Patrick have said, that it undermines our institutions in a terrible way. It's a travesty that I could personally saunter into the House offices of some of these Republicans, fake badly an Eastern European accent, and pretend that Joe Biden walked it up to me on the street and begged me for money in return for favors, and it happened, and I swear I'll testify about it, and they would say, yes, excellent. Mm-hmm. What is this? What kind of penny ante nonsense is this? It's offensive to anyone who thinks that politics is actually about something that matters. So are they humiliated? I don't know, maybe. I sort of doubt it. But if so, that would be the only good thing to come out of it.
Yeah. Thank you, Damon. Actually, sometimes, you know, as Orwell reminds us, it is the duty of intelligent men to state the obvious. And so Bill Galston, any obvious things that you would like to state about this? By the way, I say this as somebody who wrote a book in 2003 called Useful Idiots, which was highly critical of the Democrats and liberals for taking authoritarianism of the left way too lightly, and being willing to repeat Soviet talking points in some instances that I documented in the book. And I have to say that this is worse. This is worse, what the Republicans have now come to.
Well, if I had any brains, I would simply associate myself with the previous remarks and shut up. But instead, less obviously, I'm going to open my mouth and say something that's going to get me into trouble. And that is, I will always wonder where we would have been if the Democrats had not brought the first impeachment effort against Donald Trump over the Ukraine call. Would we, you know, would the Democrats have been able to persuade Republicans under those contrary to fact circumstances that impeachment was the only fitting remedy for Donald Trump's behavior after January 6th? I don't know. But I have always been of at least two minds about that initial impeachment effort.
Okay, we will, I'm not, but we'll leave it there. We'll argue it out some other time about the first impeachment. It's an interesting conundrum. And it goes to the whole question of these trials too, because you can ask the same question about the indictments. You know, what if they had not brought this, that Alvin Bragg had not brought this first indictment? Would it have been possible that then Republicans would have taken the next indictment more seriously? Some people suggest that. Anyway, these are hard things. These are unknowable sort of counterfactuals, but they are interesting to speculate about. All right, we'll leave it there for this week, and we'll turn now to our highlight or lowlight of the week. And let's start with Linda.
Well, I've got a mixed bag here. I've got a highlight about a lowlight, and it comes from Freedom House. Those who don't know Freedom House, it is for decades been responsible for looking at the world and giving a report card on autocracy and democracy, showing countries moving in one direction or another. They have a new report out, and this one is focused specifically on Central Europe to Central Asia, a swath of countries in that territory. It's called A Region Reordered by Autocracy and Democracy. It's by Mike Smeltzer and Alexander Carpi. And what they found, probably not surprising to listeners of this show, is that we've seen a move more towards autocracy in this region. And in fact, 10 countries score lower on the democracy scale in this particular report. One of the highlights, though, was that one of the countries that actually improved its score in that arena was Ukraine, which the report noted has been dealing with trying to examine and punish corruption, even in the military. And that's a very, very difficult thing to do during a war. Not surprisingly, we see the most anti-democratic countries in this region, led by Russia, but also Belarus and Azerbaijan, and then all of the various stans in that region, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Turkmenistan. And so that's my recommendation. I think it's worth a read. I think keeping tabs on what's happening with democracy in the world is always a good thing. And unfortunately, the story in recent years has not been a particularly hopeful one.
Bill Galston.
Well, this week's lowlight comes on the economic front. For the third consecutive month, inflation has come in hotter than expected or desired, which has put the kibosh on the Federal Reserve's revised and often revised timetable for beginning to lower interest rates, which means that interest rates in the fall are likely to be at or near where they are now, which means that interest for consumers on such things as mortgages, auto loans, and credit cards are likely to remain where they are now, which is not happy news, I would think, for the Biden administration. They very much wanted to see inflation continue to come down, interest rates begin to come down, and then, they could have told a very compelling story, a success story, about the fruits for the economy as a whole of what turned out to be just a temporary jump in inflation and interest rates. That particular story is going to be much harder to tell now unless there's a big downward lurch in inflation starting next month.
Or a big jump in wages.
Well, that would be nice too, but...
Yeah. Okay. Patrick Fry.
So mine is kind of a combination of a highlight and a lowlight. The low light is that there is something called the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Foundation that gives out an award for distinguished public service. And they were considering giving that to Liz Cheney, but they ended up deciding against that over concerns that basically they would end up potentially losing their nonprofit status with the IRS because they were worried that it might be viewed as some sort of, I saw Mona's look there, like, what? Because supposedly it would be viewed as some kind of political statement. That's the low light. The highlight is that there was a member of the board, a Pulitzer Prize winning political photographer named David Hume Kennerly, who resigned from the board over this and blasted the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Foundation in a letter basically just calling them cowards and saying that basically what they were worried about is that Trump might win and then try to take their, you know, be upset at them and take their tax exempt status away. And he said to them, those of you who rejected Liz join many, quote, good Republicans now aiding and abetting our 45th president by ignoring the genuine menace he presents to our country. America is fortunate to have Liz Cheney still out there on the front lines of freedom, vigorously defending our Constitution and democratic way of life, but you don't have her back. In failing to honor Liz's courage, resolve, and integrity, you are retreating and hunkering down behind a wall of silence. Martin Luther King said, in the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. And so I thought that was something of a highlight that this man was willing to stand up and make a statement like that. And to me, I just appreciate it so much because there's so few examples of courage out there in standing up to the menace that Trump presents. And I think that people like you, Mona, and some of your colleagues represent what I like to see, but I see so little of. And when we see an example like this, I really want to highlight it for people.
Well, thank you for that. Okay. Damon Linker.
Oh, gee, that was a good one.
Yes.
I would only add to that like the prospect of an America where an ostensibly independent organization makes a decision like that because they're afraid of retribution from the elected president is pretty much one of the most straightforward examples of the kind of corruption you get in an authoritarian government that you could get. I mean,
exactly. When
that starts happening down the line at agencies and corporations and things like this, that's, you know, the game's over. We're now on the other side of a threshold that I don't want to contemplate right now. That's bad. I won't say from the sublime to the ridiculous, but from the not ridiculous to the somewhat less serious, but still, culturally important issue. Last week, I felt a little bad. We talked about a poll in our third segment. And as part of that, I said a few kind of vaguely critical things about Kitsch today. and that was about a kind of lack of historical context in rendering political judgments. But one thing that a lot of people tend to say is that kids today are, you know, too anxious. They're too afraid. There's a lot of talk of being skittish and afraid to go out in the world to date. And so forth. And I, on that note, I really, really appreciated a New York Times op-ed this week by a staff psychiatrist at Boston University Health Services named Matilda Ross. The op-ed was titled in the New York Times, "Anxious Parents Are the Ones Who Need Help." And that's a very fitting headline. It was just a piece, not very long, but a good read. Just about how a lot of the times when she deals with college kids who have anxiety problems, it turns out that it is being driven by their parents. Their parents will call them up and say, "Why haven't I heard from you? What's happening?" And then the kids are like, "Oh, I don't know. I'm having fun. Nothing's going on." And instead of saying, "Good," their parents respond by saying things like, "Oh my gosh, the fact that you're not reaching out must mean that you're even more anxious than I thought you were." And this is a phenomenon of anxiety about anxiety, which is completely self-perpetuating and ends up basically you get caught in a feedback loop where nothing you hear or see ends up convincing you that actually everything is okay. It's either a problem or you're in denial about the problem. So I really appreciated that someone was willing to call that out, say what it is, and point the blame at my generation rather than those kids today. So I know it's complicated and there are, you know, lots of issues going on both levels and in different generations, but a worthwhile contribution.
Thank you for that. I'll just add that I actually know someone who, one of these kinds of parents perhaps, who insisted on going with his daughter to her first job interview when she was 23 years old. I thought, Oh, boy. Okay. Well, I would like to point to the release of a report in Great Britain. It's called the CAS report, and it was a four-year review by the National Health Service of their youth gender medicine program. And what they have concluded is that the process that they had been using of prescribing puberty blockers and then cross-sex hormones to children who presented with gender dysphoria was not based on good evidence, and that they are ending the practice. And they found that many of these children were presenting with multiple problems, multiple different issues were going on, very frequently autism, and that it's very important to treat these kids with the full picture. And so now in Great Britain, this is now the fifth country in Europe to back away from the practice that is still going on in this country of just automatically assuming that when a child reports gender dysphoria, that you have to put, you know, get them on puberty blockers right away. They are now saying that they will not give puberty blockers except in very controlled circumstances for clinical trials. And they have urged extreme caution about giving cross-sex hormones also. Now, it's very important to be clear that this is not about whether you respect and honor adults who are transgender. That's not what this is about. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people on the right who are genuinely anti-trans and try to use that as a cudgel. This is about children and medicine and evidence and a bullying trend that has happened where even medical professionals feel that they can't speak honestly about what they have seen and what they think for fear of being shouted down or called transphobic or called a child abuser by these activists who tend to dominate the space. And so I think it's really worth looking at what's happening in Europe, and time for a very, very, very strong application of the brakes to this practice in the United States as well. And let's hope that that happens. With that, I want to thank our guest, Patrick Fry, and of course, my regular panel, also our producer, Jim Swift, our sound engineer, Jonathan Seary, and Beg to Differ will be back next week, as every week.